was not born in the city, and my family are what we called مغتربين, you know. They worked in the Gulf area, so they were not like, you know, this big name family that is going to take up space just because they're from that family. So I was known for my talent, but there was always a limit. There was always a wall that I would hit. I remember at one point, a couple of people from that facade, that art facade that existed in the city at the time, they told me, you're not as talented as you think you are. And actually, this is something that continued to repeat itself in places where I found out eventually that I was actually being oppressed in this place. I've been limited by that notion that you're not as talented as you think you are.
Was that only based on the fact that you wanted to take part in the arts, or was it, you know, God forbid, gender discrimination? Was that involved in it or not?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things.
Yeah.
When it comes to art, and we'll probably talk more about it in a little bit. When it comes to art, it's very, very important for art to be controlled in whichever, for various reasons. Sometimes it's for really simple reasons, like it's just us five here. We have the funding for those five people, and that's what we're going to do. Everyone else can go away. But sometimes it's for much more serious reasons. It's silencing. It's like trying to avoid telling specific stories. And that's what art is. It's storytelling. And after those few slaps in the face, like you're not as talented as you think you are, and so on and so on, I was really successful in the graphic design world. I had started with a couple of friends on an agency, and then it became the second spending agency in town. We had the biggest accounts and within 3 years. And then there was a filmmaking workshop in town, which was, we didn't have any film schools in Jordan. I plugged into that and then started
into filmmaking
and started making simple films with our friends.
Of course, we'll get to that.
And we'll get to that.
Yeah, but what was your very first work of art? You said illustrations and all. What was that very first work of art that you really, you know, look back at and, you know, really appreciate that was my very first, you know, piece of art that I presented to the world? Can you remember?
I have no idea. I can't remember. And my mom would complain about how many paintings she had to clear out of the house after I left it, because I'm constantly painting.
Painting, yeah.
Until I didn't, for 10 years. Until I stopped painting for 10 years.
So there was
years.
A gap. And that was because when you wanted to study for finance?
That's when I moved to the United States when I was in my late 20s.
Mm-hmm. Why was there a gap? Because for a person who paints all, you know, all their life, suddenly a 10-year gap, that's huge.
Right.
Why was that?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's that you're not as good as you think you are. Not that I thought that I was good, but it was like, it was a preconceived notion. Like, you think you're good, you're not as good as you are. So I stopped thinking that I was good.
Is it imposter syndrome, something like that?
I don't know. I know my reaction to it. I don't know what the intention behind it was, but my reaction to it, no, I'm not going to think that I'm good. I'm just not going to think it. Mm-hmm. So that I want to be humble, right?
Yeah.
And then I moved to the United States. And the United States was a very, very rough transition for someone who lived in a very sheltered family, in a very sheltered city, in a very...
From a very small locality to a very big, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you move also, and there's also like, when I talk about the United States, I'm always talking about the capitalist aspect of things.
Yeah.
So in the United States, I'm working as a freelance designer, and I can only rent this specific apartment. And God forbid I would hang anything on the walls, because if I ruin the walls, I'm going to have to pay I don't know how much in
The tenant rules,
insurance,
right?
If one drop of acrylic paint falls on the carpet, I'm going to be destroyed when I leave this apartment. And so you kind of want to protect the things that you have and stop seeing yourself. The things become more important than you.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to paint on big canvases with acrylic colors.
And creating a mess as well.
And creating a big mess. Yeah. Because it's part of the...
It is.
It's like playtime.
It is,
right?
It is.
You have rules everywhere, but here you don't have none. And so I stopped for 10 years. And then I went through life. I started organizing. I lived in St. Louis for the first 10 years in my life in the United States. And in St. Louis, and St. Louis was a very interesting city because part of it is on the Missouri state and part of it is on the Illinois state. And it's one of the most segregated cities in the world, in the United States for sure. It had all these promises back in the days. It was supposed to be bigger than Chicago, but because of the segregation that exists within, it just froze. And I lived in it for 8 years. And I kept bumping into walls and not understanding, you know, like you come to the U.S. and you're thinking, oh, this is the dream and this is where
freedom,
I'm going. Freedom,
the land of the free and all that, yeah.
And art. And then you go there and you feel like you're constantly being put down, but you don't understand why. And, no. And then Ferguson happens on August 9, 2014. At the time, I was organizing with Palestinian groups. And we had coalitions, and we had had the first BDS win in the United States where we divested from a water company that was supposed to ruin the water supply in St. Louis. And so there was this young man, his name is Mike Brown. He was 18 years old, and he was shot right in front of his house. And he was left without being covered for 4.5 hours for everyone in the neighborhood to see. And an uprising or protest, whatever you want to call it, just erupted. And black youth reached out to Palestinians in town to start organizing with them. And that's when I understood, oh, I live in a segregated racist system. It took me 8 years to really understand.
To really feel it.
To start understanding. I still don't understand it fully, to be honest.
Yeah.
But to start understanding, and so that's the problem. And so you learn a lot from black women, particularly in these spaces, about who you are as a person, about your presence as a woman, your power as a woman. And because of my organizing there, I got fired from my job at the time. My office, I used to work in an advertising agency, and my office was right across the street from the DOJ. And 2 months later, lo and behold, I was fired from my job. I was the only one cut from my job. And there were so many repercussions based on it because there was supposed to be a community that is supposed to protect me legally from that because it was a clear clear retaliation. The city is so segregated. I'm Palestinian. I'm brown. I'm a woman who's protesting against racism in that city.
The usual case.
Exactly. No, well, yeah, it was usual, but I was so ignorant. I really didn't know that it was the usual case. So I thought it was like exclusive and I needed to just let things go. And that community support that I was hoping that I would get was non-existent. Something's got put under the rug and people moved on. And I started not feeling very safe in the city. I started getting death threats at the time. So I decided to move to California. And in California was a much more stronger shift. California is everything at the same time, right? I worked in Silicon Valley as a designer running brand teams for big tech companies. But I was also going through so much at the time on a personal level. And I just needed to not talk to anyone for 2 hours a day. And I got a very small notepad with just ink, because ink is not going to make a big mess in my apartment. And I got a small notepad because I didn't know if I could paint anymore. It's been 10 years.
My God.
10 years.
Yeah.
And
picking up a pen after 10 years, you know.
Picking up a pen and being by yourself and painting. It's everything that you're afraid of at the same time. And yeah. My decision was not to paint about something specific, just to let go. I'm not going to look at a picture, or I just want to see what I have within. And I started painting roots and roots and roots and roots, and only a little leaf coming out from them on the surface. And I knew after that painting that I could still paint. And then now I have to make a decision. And also to answer your question, when did you think that you were, then I realized, you don't paint something and then you say, oh, I'm an artist. You paint something and then you have to choose, I will become an artist. Because being an artist entails a lot of things. And it's a lot of commitment. And it's a lot of self-esteem work that you have to work on. And I had to make a choice to make that decision.
And perhaps that's why you needed a 10-year gap.
Probably.
For that, as you said, that humbleness to come back in.
Right.
And rediscover your, arts and craftsmanship.
And to grow, generally.
Yeah, to grow.
To be able to understand the relationship between art and the story. Because I've been, working on film to tell stories, but I thought that was completely different in art. And art is about feeling and what you think and the colors. But for me, at least, it turns out that it was the story part that I was missing. Like, what is the story that I want to tell?
The why in creating art,
exactly.
In producing art. That's the thing you had to reach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then at that point, I decided that I have to, if I choose to become an artist, what is my art going to be about?
Mm-hmm.
And usually artists, what I've seen artists do is that they have these shows where they get funding in advance and they say, I'm going to make it about autumn or about this.
Yeah, give a theme, yeah.
But it didn't work for me that way. For me, it was like, I'm just going to paint and figure out over the years what is going to come out.
And how are you going to put it on display?
Yes. And what is the meaning of it, too? Because some of it is like literally from my heart. Like I see things on the paper and I paint them. I trust that they need to be there. And then years later, something happens and an image is replicated. It's exactly what I had painted. It's like me connecting with the ink, with the water, with the stories around me. It's just being honest, like true to yourself at that point.
The dream of every artist is for their artwork to shine, for the artist to be able to communicate to the world through their art, and as you said, tell that story. And of course, every artist wants their art to be unique as well, to stand out, wherever they go. That's my piece of work. That's my piece of work. It stands out. Something very interesting about your work, your artwork, is that, you use the colors black and yellow, or charcoal, or dark grey, something like that, okay? First of all, tell us, what's the reason? Why? Why these two colours?
There are so many different reasons, Hassan, and every time someone asks me that question, I can come up with another reason.
Really?
But what's
the main thing that you recurringly answer?
I think there are, two aspects to it. There's the spiritual and there's the material itself. The material itself is easy. Black is, it doesn't consume me with thinking of what are the colors that I am feeling right now, and it's how I feel. It's like how I feel on the inside. It's sad.
The colors do represent, a certain theme, a certain idea, a certain, thought. Yeah?
But black can represent everything at the same time. And also ink itself, it was the beginning of how we started accumulating knowledge as humanity, right? This is how it became more available for everybody. And knowledge is the spirit, right? This is how we became spiritual, is by being able to write things down or paint things on paper. And so I kind of wanted to carry on with that ancestral knowledge of what does ink mean to us as as humanity. The gold itself is because, on the spiritual level, is because I see us as gold. I see my people as beautiful people, they are the gold of the earth. No matter what happens around them, they still shine like gold. But from a space perspective too, whenever the light hits the painting, the gold changes with the light. So it stays living, it keeps moving as time goes by, and it's always going to be changing based on lights, and lights is never the same, right? So it's going to always have different meanings to it.
It's very, very interesting. And some of your illustrations, I mean, we were looking through your artwork, it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, okay, it seems that there were already pictures taken before and you painted off of them, yeah?
Yes, because I'm a graphic designer by nature.
Yeah.
And also a filmmaker. And we have this thing where we use a picture that is familiar to people.
A well-known picture, yeah.
Exactly. And you build on it. Mm-hmm. And especially in my study about martyrs, it's like there are specific photos that I want to be remembered. So there, for example, my generation has been really imprinted by the death of Muhammad Durra. I think at that point we realized that even our fathers can protect us from this enemy, this vicious enemy. And no, our fathers, who are the strongest men we know in the world, still can't protect us. And that does something to you. It makes you want to stand on your own feet and figure out a way to protect your own father as well. But all of the paintings that have been painted about Muhammad, who's left that much of an impact, yeah. He was always in them scared, at least the ones that I've seen. And I didn't want to leave him scared in my painting. Mm-hmm. So I found one of his pictures and painted him where he was looking down on us, like he's looking from the sky.
Oh.
In complete peace, because that's where I wanted him to be.
Indeed.
So that's why I use photography, because it's like something that already exists. We're just building on it. It's kind of like a wish.
Yeah.
It's a study in, no,
it is.
How would he have been, right? So that's why it's because I'm a graphic designer and because I want to build on that story, pre-existing story.
Well, thank you, Sohad.
Of course. Thank you.
And we thank our guest, Sohad Khatib from Jordan, for taking part in this program. Until another program, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team, is goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, and my two guests, Said Abdullah and Pradi Yasser. Thank you very much for coming here, and assalamu alaikum to you, Said Abdullah. Let me start with you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and Brother Yasser, salam to you too.
Alaikum salam, Brother Muhammad Jawad. Always a pleasure to be with you.
You're welcome. And one of those movies that we want to, in fact, start criticizing, rather religiously speaking, of course, not artistically, is The First Omen. Actually, it's very much different, I'm going to add, that from the Omen series, although it's a kind of improvement on it. This is a rather new movie. It was produced in 2024, directed by Akasha Stevenson. You know, featuring these actors and actresses such as Nell Tiger-Free, Mariah Caballero, Nicole Soros, Ralph Innocent, just to name a few. A woman starts to question her own faith when she uncovers a terrifying conspiracy to bring about the birth of evil incarnate in Rome. Very interesting move. Well, IMDb actually gives this, you know, movie, The First Omen, 6.5 out of 10. Rotten Tomato, 82%. Film Affinity, 6 out of 10. And the box office for this movie was $53.9 million. Let's take a listen to this movie, of course, through a trailer of this movie, The First Omen, produced in 2024. Directed by Akasha Stevenson, and then we'll be back and continue our program Viewpoints on RIB English Radio.
You don't have to be afraid. This child is his way.
Back to the program, Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and Syed Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie The First Omen, produced in 2024, directed by Akasha Stevenson. Syed Abdullah, let me start with you in this episode. How does this movie, I mean The First Omen, pay homage to the original Omen movie or series, basically?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, I mean, this is not a... It's a prequel, as they call it.
Yes.
A prequel to the first Omen. It's just... It conveys the same story, basically. They're trying to bring the Antichrist. Nothing new there. Pretty much same characters, same names. Mm-hmm. It's just they brought it in a different... into more of a modern... technology kind of thing. So if you look at the old Omens, they were quite old, even in terms of color, choreography, I don't know, whatever they want to call it these days, in terms of cinematic
features.
So now it's been done with more, they had like more CGI stuff happening, the colors and everything else. They can do more. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, they're just trying to kickstart the entire series back again with all the advances they have in terms of cinematic capabilities. Mm-hmm. So this is being, the name gives it away, being the first Omen, is that they're trying to go back to the beginning.
I see.
And tell you exactly what happened and how everything happened. And then obviously the series will take.
Yeah, how did you like the movie, especially in comparison with the Omen series?
I like the old ones much better.
Uh-huh.
The old ones were much, they had much more suspense.
I see.
I don't know, maybe it's the black and white kind of feel to it, or the old feel to
it. Or maybe you are desensitized actually to such movies, like with the scary movies.
Maybe,
you know?
Maybe that is quite a good possibility, because we got so much sick of watching all these movies, it doesn't make sense anymore. We're not tasting it anymore. So the old ones
makes
more sense.
Yeah.
And even like the style of the movie, the music they have, back in the day was, even though it wasn't much like dramatic and action-wise captivating as now, but it has a bit of suspense to it. It's just as if you can tell what's going to happen. That's the problem.
Okay. Brother Yasser, what are some of the supernatural elements in this movie? I mean, the first Omen.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So one of the supernatural things also we can actually maybe take out from this movie is the concept of these true visions. Mm. And these true visions, not to say that we don't believe in them, mm-hmm. but also, you know, we have this thing in the Islamic, especially within the concept of Islamic mysticism, what is known as khawatir. Khawatir are three types. You have a khawatir that is divine, one that is neutral, meaning it comes from yourself, it has no value mm-hmm. as per se. And then you have one that is demonic, satanic.
Would you please define actually or translate khawatir? Because I know that it's very much different from thought.
No, it's very different. Yeah. So khawatir basically it comes from the word khatara, mm-hmm. which in here it doesn't just mean thought.
It doesn't mean memory.
It doesn't mean memory.
Yeah.
It means something that has been implanted in you
exactly.
from an outside source.
Yeah. Or you are inspired
by it. It's inspiration, but it's, for example, it's either a divine inspiration. Mm-hmm. Again, a very different inspiration because... when it happens is also important mm-hmm. because sometimes it happens during sleep, sometimes it happens when you're awake. It depends on the state of the person who's having this particular feeling or this inspiration. Again, the English doesn't do justice to what it actually is. Mm-hmm. So here, for example, one of those things, and like I said, sometimes you see that there's a lot of truth in some of these movies. Mm. I mean, even because of religious things and amongst the religious sects, and even religions in general, there are a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. And well, there is a reason for that, saying coming from one truth,
yes.
so to speak.
Exactly.
But here, for example, when it comes to these visions and these particular foretellings that mm-hmm. something will happen,
right.
or something will happen, or you will be able to do something, not to do with deja vu also, like this is something true that
exactly,
will happen later
yeah.
on, right? It's not like... I think I've seen it. No, it's something that an outside source, whatever mm. the outside source may be, is mm. implanting something within you to show you something that's going to happen.
Yes.
So this is one of the things, for example, that is mm-hmm. shown in the movie. Another one, for example, is obviously, we know, is our good friend Satan, the devil, Lucifer, many other names that you can call him. He's always there in all of these movies.
Yes.
But it's also a truth, though, again.
Yeah.
It's a truth that in all religions... this concept of light and dark, good and evil,
yeah.
is always there.
All of them appear and reappear. You know.
Yeah, it's always there, right? It's something that is so ingrained within human nature. Mm. Why that is a different discussion altogether. But for example, this thing of evil, of this pushing away light, of trying to bring down God's law, mm. to take down those who are believing in God, is something
yes.
that has always been there.
Or
will always be there. Till the day of judgment, it will be there.
Yeah.
And all religions in different forms, different structures and stuff will be represented by it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Brother Yasser. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The man you are looking for, the U.S. ambassador to Rome, he will be the new father. He and his wife will suffer a tragic loss and be in need of a child. The boy will inherit their privilege and power. Soon, his darkness will spread, and the world shall be saved.
Back to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, Abdullah and Brother Yasser, helping me criticize the movie The First Omen, produced in 2024, directed by Arkasha Stevenson. Said Abdullah, what are some of the themes explored in The First Omen?
Well, to begin with, there is the battle of good and evil,
mm-hmm.
Dark and light, Satan and God, I guess, the Jesus and the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
These are the themes. Morality against, what's the verses of morality?
immorality.
Immorality. Mm. Yeah. So these are the themes that have been explored because in trying to bring the Antichrist, you always have this moral dilemma of mm-hmm. whether it is right or wrong.
Yes.
Or even whether the means justify the goal or the goal justify the means. Because they're trying to bring the Antichrist in the most of horrendous a moral way just so they can bring people back to God.
Yes.
So these are the concepts that this movie touches upon, whether morally, what do you stand? Because I think this, even from an Islamic perspective, I remember there's a group in Iraq, they've done the exact same thing. What they're trying to create a lot of corruption. They were trying to get people to create corruption.
Mm.
And when they asked why, they said, we're trying to bring Imam Zaman. Because he only comes when there's corruption.
Yes. Do you think that this movie in particular, in fact, did justice to these themes, like the battle between good and evil, the power of faith, or whatever, the nature of evil, or Antichrist?
I don't think it done enough, because back in the day, the previous ones, they were mainly focused on the Antichrist and bringing the Antichrist.
Right.
So this is like, it had that dark theme in it, trying to have that figure come back to life. With this one, they kind of lost it a little bit. I think they were
confused, I guess.
No, just confused. I think, from my personal opinion, I don't know, like when watching this movie, there was like a lot of hints of like sexuality in it, like it's very sexualized.
Mm.
So the whole thing revolves around a woman having to get pregnant. I don't know. It turned out at the end of the day, it was the jackal that was sleeping with her, right? Mm. Which is an animal. Mm. So it had very sexual like imagery, very sexual thoughts, and very sexual visions.
I see.
So it didn't do justice to the old ones.
Yeah, exactly, Brother Yasser. One of the major, in fact, concepts or themes in this movie was Antichrist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? I mean, what is Antichrist?
Look, we have this again, going back to the biggest conundrum we have in this world of light and dark and good and evil. So with light, there must be an absolute representation of what that light is.
Mm.
So in Christendom, we have obviously the light of Jesus, Isa alayhi salam, the Son of God, who sacrificed everything so that man can be saved. Therefore, on the other side, which is obviously the dark and the evil, you must have an absolute representation of what that thing is, which obviously therefore is the Antichrist, which is a particular being that manifests absolute corruption and darkness. That whatever it does, it will make a human being or whatever it is, follow it, become completely corrupt and take it to the depths of hell. Basically, he wants to bring hell on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Jesus wants to bring heaven on earth.
Yes.
He wants to bring
hell on earth.
So that's the thing. We have this also in Islamic
eschatology
and normal Islamic mysticism and so on and so forth, with the concept of Dajjal, that a person again will come in order to deceive people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is again a test for all of us, not only the Christians. Every single individual at that time will have a test of faith.
Yes.
Like, would you just this magic or magic again in inverted commas?
Do we look at the same concept? Do we look at the same entity when we speak about Antichrist, whether you're a Christian or a Muslim?
It could be similar, but again, the words may just be a different word.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it may represent the same thing.
I see.
That the Antichrist or Dajjal is representing that particular darkness, that particular evil. Whereas, for example, in Islam, we may say, okay, that particular light at that time will be the final Imam al-Zaman. Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajhum sharif. May Allah hasten his reappearance. Whereas in Christian theology, at this particular moment in time, even then, Jesus will still be the representation of that light.
True. Thank you very much, Brother Yasser. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoints, the movie critic program on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to criticize the movie The First Omen, produced in 2024, directed by Akasha Stevenson. Of course, we haven't finished it, and inshallah, we'll do so in the upcoming episodes. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining an important question. And that question is related to one of the virtues which Islam has encouraged its followers to adopt. I'm speaking of the remembrance of God. Remembering God is one of the cardinal and significant and central virtues within Islam. And conversely, forgetfulness of God, forgetting Him, which we call ghaflat, being negligent of Him, these are vices that Islam has discouraged. The question we want to pose today in this regard is, what are the effects and results of someone forgetting God and disregarding the remembrance of God? To answer this question, we can take inspiration from the Quran and the Hadith. In light of these Quranic verses and Hadith, we can answer this question. In one beautiful verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following: "But whoever disregards my remembrance, his shall be a wretched life. And on the day of resurrection, we will raise him blind. He will say, 'My Lord, why have you raised me blind, though I used to see?' He will say, 'So it is. Our signs came to you, but you forgot them. And thus you will be forgotten today.'" So in this beautiful verse, Allah Ta'ala, He says that one of the effects of disregarding God's remembrance is that the person's life will be wretched. The actual wording of the verse is ma'ishatan zanka. Perhaps this could be translated as a stressful life. That's probably a very good translation of this word. Also, this is the worldly effect of disregarding God's remembrance. In the hereafter, the other worldly effect of forgetting God and disregarding His remembrance is that a person will be raised blind, and he will be forgotten by God. By blind, the verse wants to say that he will be ignorant of certain truths on a day when the righteous will be able to witness certain truths and enjoy that vision. This person will be barred from that vision and he will not be allowed to see that. And, he will be forgotten by God. In another verse, we read the following: "Whoever turns a blind eye to the remembrance of the All-Beneficent, we assign him a devil who remains his companion." Right? So, by forgetting God, our associate becomes an evil person. It could be a person, or it could be a supernatural being, right? Who encourages us and pushes us to bad deeds. this is, you know, one of the worldly effects of disregarding God's remembrance, and obviously it has a otherworldly effect as well. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the effects of disregarding the remembrance of God in the light of the Quranic verses. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The Reign of Terror. In the midst of the Reign of Terror during the late 18th century, a term was forged in the fiery tumult of the French Revolution: terrorism. This term, born from the shadows of La Guillotine, would traverse the rivers of time, its echo resonating into the modern era. Originally shaped by the Blade's swift justice around the 1790s, this legacy of fear has morphed across centuries into a narrative starkly different. From the cobblestone streets of Paris in the late 18th century, we leap forward in time. In the volatile atmosphere of 1960 South Africa, the oppressive apartheid regime enforced stringent pass laws, which required black South Africans to carry Dompas passbooks controlling their movements and freedoms. The enforcement of these laws was harsh and abusive, leading to widespread resentment. In Sharpeville, a township simmering under these conditions, the residents, supported by the Pan-Africanist Congress, PAC, organized a peaceful protest by gathering at the local police station without their passbooks, aiming to challenge and overwhelm the apartheid system. The situation escalated dramatically when police opened fire on the unarmed crowd, resulting in the tragic death of 69 people and over 180 injuries. This brutal event intensified the resistance against the apartheid. Nelson Mandela, a key figure in the African National Congress, ANSC, responded by advocating a shift towards armed struggle. By 1961, Mandela helped found Umkhonto weSizwe, Spear of the Nation, marking a significant change in tactics. However, this move led to the US designating the ANC as a terrorist organization during the Cold War era. Mandela was included on the US terror watch list, a designation that lasted until 2008, long after his presidency, when a US bill finally removed ANC members from the list. This action underscored the complex global response to Mandela's fight against the apartheid and his eventual recognition as a global symbol of peace and reconciliation. As the sands of time shift to 2021, we find ourselves in Palestine, where the populace contends with a distinct form of apartheid. Tensions in Palestine mirrored struggles from other regions while manifesting unique and profound local challenges. In the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, East Al-Quds, the issuance of eviction notices to Palestinians under a contentious Israeli law sparked significant protests. This law, allowing descendants of former Jewish property owners to reclaim lands but not affording the same right to displaced Palestinians, heightened tensions. Human Rights Watch labeled Israel's policies in the region, which include segregation and movement restrictions to maintain Jewish dominance, as apartheid. Yahya Sinwar, born in 1962 into a family displaced by the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, emerged as a significant figure in this context. His journey from poverty to leadership within Hamas was marked by his early involvement with Islamic student groups and his subsequent imprisonment in 1988 for actions against Palestinian collaborators and Israeli soldiers. Released in 2011 in a prisoner exchange, Sinwar rose to prominence in Hamas, leading its military and political strategies against the Israeli apartheid system. His stance and actions led to his inclusion on the US terror list in 2015. By 2017, Yahya Sinwar had taken the helm of Hamas in Gaza, focusing on resisting the Israeli apartheid. This campaign against Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian territories culminated dramatically on October 7, 2023, with Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. In a highly coordinated military operation, Hamas fighters on paragliders and motorcycles, in a daring assault, shattered the fortified barriers between Gaza and the occupied territories. They successfully dismantled the AI-augmented surveillance systems, enabling them to strike at over 25 Israeli military outposts with precision. The operation saw the capture of several Merkava tanks and their crews at the Kerem Shalom military site, with significant military equipment seized and taken back to Gaza. This operation marked a significant breach in Israel's military, reminiscent of the vulnerabilities exposed during the 1973 Arab-Israeli conflict. During Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Hamas demonstrated a remarkable display of military capability. Yet, Western media and key political figures, including US President Joe Biden, tried to frame this operation as an act of terrorism. They portrayed the events of October 7th with stark comparisons to Daesh actions, including unverified claims of war crimes and beheadings, a narrative echoed by Biden. In the 2010s, the emergence of Daesh became a prominent example of how Western media frequently linked terrorism with Islam and West Asia, diverging significantly from its historical origins in the heart of Europe. Daesh, also known as ISIS or ISIL in the West, was founded by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and gained international notoriety in 2014. Following swift and brutal military campaigns that made Iraqi forces retreat from key cities and led to the seizure of Mosul. Characterized by extreme brutality, Daesh committed atrocities that shocked the world, including mass executions, ethnic cleansing, enslavement, and the persecution of minorities. Notable incidents included the Sinjar massacre, where thousands of Izzadis were killed, and the mass murder of over 2,000 cadets at a military academy in Tikrit, coupled with severe damage to Iraq's infrastructure. However, their reign of terror ended when Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, declared the cessation of their existence after years of horrific violence in Iraq and Syria. Years after the end of the Daesh rule, shadows of the past loomed large. This time, another dark spectre cast its pall over Gaza, where the scars of the genocide are deep and unyielding. The region reeled under the weight of the Israeli-American genocide, a stark and haunting reflection of the atrocities once committed by Daesh. Israel's crimes in Gaza encompass collective punishments such as blockades, indiscriminate bombings of civilian areas, forced displacements, direct targeting of civilians, unlawful detentions, and destruction of civilian infrastructure. These measures have led to significant civilian casualties and suffering. When examining these actions, the distinction in scale between blockades by Daesh and Israel becomes clear. Daesh's blockades affected smaller populations, with around 6,250 civilians in Yarmouk and approximately 50,000 in Fallujah. In stark contrast, Israel's blockade impacted the entire population of Gaza, over 2 million people. This blockade resulted in severe shortages of essential services and significant civilian casualties, making it a form of collective punishment, prohibited under international law. Targeting hospitals and schools has also been a tactic used by both Daesh and Israeli forces. Daesh utilized these civilian infrastructures for military purposes in areas like Mosul and across Syria, which shielded them from airstrikes. Conversely, Israeli airstrikes directly hit schools and hospitals in Gaza. By late September 2024, Gaza's healthcare infrastructure had been devastated. Of the 36 hospitals in the region, 31 had been damaged or destroyed. The World Health Organization reported that from October 7, 2023, until the end of September 2024, over 1,100 attacks had targeted healthcare services in both Gaza and the West Bank. These strikes had affected more than 550 medical facilities and over 500 ambulances, severely crippling the region's ability to provide essential care. One of the most harrowing events was a 14-day operation at Gaza's largest medical facility, Al-Shifa Hospital, where Israeli military actions included the killing of 13 children and systematic violence, including extrajudicial killings of Palestinian civilians. Children aged 4 to 6 were among those tragically killed, with the WHO citing 21 patients perishing in dire conditions within the hospital. The use of white phosphorus by Israeli forces, a substance causing severe injuries and death, has been documented and criticized by Human Rights Watch. This contrasts with Daesh, which has not been recorded using this substance. Forced displacement figures are equally stark. Daesh displaced thousands, while Israel's actions since October 7th forcibly displaced nearly 2 million Palestinians, nearly 90% of Gaza's population. This massive displacement was a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits the forcible transfer of protected persons from occupied territories. Targeting of civilians by Israel has been severe. Over a span of 1 year, Israel killed more than 40,000 civilians, including attacks on residential areas and public spaces, a significant increase compared to Daesh, which killed 5,054 civilians over 13 years. Journalists have also been targeted. According to the Syrian Network for Human Rights, Daesh was responsible for the execution of at least 64 journalists, using these heinous acts as a tactic to suppress information and sow fear. In a stark contrast, the toll has been much higher in Israel's case. The Committee to Protect Journalists reported that, As of the 24th of May 2024, at least 107 journalists and media workers were killed since the onset of the conflict, marking the deadliest period for journalists since CPJ started recording data in 1992. Mass graves are another example of Israeli atrocities in Gaza. One of the largest mass graves tied to Daesh was unearthed near the town of Sinjar in Iraq after the region was liberated from their control in 2015. This grave held the remains of over 80 Izadi women, a chilling testimony to the terrorist group's brutal campaign. However, the situation in Gaza presents an even more somber narrative. In April 2024, the discovery of mass graves there sent shockwaves through the international community. The largest of these was found at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, where, following the withdrawal of Israeli troops, Palestinian civil defense teams began the grim work of exhuming bodies. The United Nations Human Rights Relief, Volker Turk, expressed his horror upon learning that hundreds of bodies were found in mass graves at two of Gaza's major hospitals. Palestinian authorities reported the recovery of nearly 400 bodies, some of whom were tragically found still clad in surgical gowns. The deceased ranged from elderly women to young men and children, presenting a harrowing and stark tableau of the tragic events. Throughout its campaign in Syria and Iraq, Daesh extensively used explosive weapons in populated areas such as Mosul and Raqqa, resulting in significant civilian casualties. Similarly, Israel has employed a comparable tactic on a much larger scale. By April 2024, over 60% of Gaza's physical infrastructure had been damaged, with 35% completely destroyed. The devastation was so extensive that the EU policy chief Joseph Borrell remarked that the destruction in Gaza exceeded what was seen in German cities during World War II. Israeli forces dropped at least 75,000 tons of explosives on the region, about five times the explosive yield of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The widespread use of explosive weapons in densely populated areas has drawn condemnation from the UN and various human rights organizations, stating that such actions likely violate international humanitarian law due to the disproportionate harm caused to civilians. The relentless bombardment led the International Court of Justice to call on Israel to end its genocidal campaign in Rafah, the southernmost town in Gaza. But the Israeli authorities had nothing to be ashamed of. Despite the international outcry, certain Israeli officials, including Flor Hassan Nahum, deputy mayor of Al-Quds, have denied allegations of war crimes. Meanwhile, others have defended their war crimes, including the deprivation of basic necessities in Gaza. Tali Gottlieb, a member of the Likud party, controversially asserted in a Knesset meeting that weaponizing hunger and thirst could be effective for gathering intelligence. Additionally, May Golan, Israel's Minister of Women's Advancement, expressed pride in the severe destruction of Gaza and the killing of Palestinian children. On the other side of the conflict, Israel has directed accusations of war crimes towards Hamas. During Elon Musk's visit to the Kfar Azar kibbutz, a site of Operation Al-Aqsa flood, Israel depicted itself as a victim, claiming Hamas targeted civilians. This narrative was echoed in Kibbutz Be'eri, where initial reports of an alleged massacre were later contradicted by settler testimonies. Israeli Yasmin Porat, who survived the events at Be'eri, shockingly stated on Israeli radio that it was the Israeli military fire, not Hamas, that caused settler casualties. This included incidents of strong crossfire and tank fire resulting in civilian deaths. Further controversy arose when Ifrat Katz, reportedly held captive by Hamas, was killed in an Israeli helicopter strike intended to stop the Palestinian fighters. The Israeli Air Force commander